Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
At Merriwest Credit Union, we're working towards a brighter financial future for both our members and our community, knowing that when you succeed, we all succeed. That starts with a solid financial foundation. As a credit union, we have no stockholders demanding profits. Our commitment is to our members. Experience the difference with our Money Market Max Bonus promotion, offering a cash incentive for letting us protect and grow your money. Merriwest Credit Union, working for you. Today, tomorrow, together. Merriwest Credit Union is insured by NCUA.
My name's Chris Lambert.
And my name is Travis Bain.
Welcome to Film Colossus,
your guide to movies.
You, the one with that smile, yeah, come over here for a while. Hey girl, do you hear what I say? I don't have time to be waiting all day. Just believe that it's not all so wrong.
Well, today we're talking about a movie I've seen a ton of times.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Ooh, a lot. Such a tease, too. We haven't said what the movie is yet.
I know. That's
is it part of Fight Club? I'm trying to think of Chris. Is it Fight Club?
It's not Fight Club.
Is it The Lion King?
It is. I mean, I've seen Fight Club and The Lion King way more than this movie.
Oh, okay. Is it Showgirls? No way. That would be if I said it. I give up.
Black Swan.
Oh, good thing I watched that movie this week.
I'm ready to talk about that. The timing.
This was a movie. God, what year did this movie come out? I feel like it came out in 2010. That's like, it is. Okay. Like in the regresses of my mind, I was like, this movie feels like it came out right in 2010. Right when I graduated from college, and which was a year rich with me, like watching so many movies. Just coming out of college and like having a lot of time on my hand because I wasn't able to get a job and watching a lot of movies. And yeah, Black Swan, that was a big one that year.
You were going to the theater a lot?
Not really. I mean, I would definitely go to the theater. My then girlfriend, now wife, I guess I can call her my ex-girlfriend at this point. we did go to a lot of movies, and I imagine I saw this in a movie, yeah. But I also watched a lot of movies like on my laptop and stuff.
Oh yeah, those were the days, right? The laptop viewing experience.
I mean, it honestly, like, it makes me shiver thinking of all the great movies I watched on my laptop. But like, I'm just racing to rewatch them on a big screen now because it's to do them justice.
Right, 4K, nice TV.
Yeah, if I can do it in 4K for sure, but yeah, at least like not on my laptop.
had you watched, like, were you familiar with Darren Aronofsky at that point?
Oh yeah, that was the thing I was gonna say. Is Darren Aronofsky? He's really beloved. Like, he has a very strong following. A lot of his movies are highly searched, as Chris and I know. Like Mother and like The Wrestler, Noah, Requiem for a Dream. Like, they're all like straightforward in quotes. Like, they're just simple movies kind of on their face, but they have all these little touches and little nuances that kind of drive people wild. And they constantly search for like this movie explained. And I remember early on, like, there was this obsession with Pi, like his first movie. And I was desperate to watch Pi in college, and luckily I went to this Southern Illinois University of Carbondale, which, I mean, that school's whatever, but they had an intense movie selection in their library, so I could get like any movie I wanted. And I remember like Pi being one of those movies, like, yeah, gotta see Pi. So early on, I was like way into Aronofsky.
Okay, and Pi like hit for you. It was one where you're like, oh, this is good. I get why people are talking about it.
Definitely. I think back then I really latched on to anything that was like experimental and outside of the norm. I was like railing against like blockbusters and, you know, like
oh, anything that times have changed.
I know, right? Well, no, I just like everything. Yeah. but back then, definitely that kind of movie spoke to me.
Nice. I saw Pi after Black Swan.
Mm-hmm.
I think my first Aronofsky movie was The Fountain.
Oh, The Fountain. Oh, yeah. I have a story about that one, too.
Yeah, it was like college. I remember the trailers mm-hmm. coming out for it, and it was like right in my wheelhouse of wanting. I spent a lot of middle school and high school reading fantasy and like not as much sci-fi, but like definitely some like sci-fi influence. So the fact that this movie was mixing like time periods and had some of this like conquistador like looking for like sword fights and magic like aspects to it, I was just completely enamored from the trailer, especially with some of that imagery, and remember going to the theater. Like, I was amazed that the theater in Canton, Ohio had The Fountain, and I was like, because I feel like that came out, because even though I was in college, I feel like it came out at a time I was home. It was like Thanksgiving weekend or something.
Sure.
So I was just like one of like four people in the theater watching this movie being like, oh my goodness, like it really like stood out. And that was right around the time I was discovering like Christopher Nolan as well. So there was something to like The Prestige and The Fountain, yeah, and
totally. It
feeling like there was this new era of filmmaker.
That time period. Yeah, completely. Like you saying those two movies together, like, that's what movies were then. It's like what movie nerds were craving.
Yeah, right. Like that was the not underground. Like I think we thought it was underground, but right. It was like still mainstream enough to be like nationally played. But
for sure, like they were well known. But it's not like Nolan and Aronofsky were the major players they are now, where like they completely command attention. You know, at least back then, it almost did kind of feel like they had a cult following.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, then Black Swan, like, I like The Fountain. I don't think I love The Fountain. I think it's one that I've come to appreciate more over time.
Mm-hmm.
But my, like, hype for it on initial viewing, I was just like, ah, okay. But The Wrestler, I was, like,
great movie.
Really in love with. And then, so for Black Swan, it was something where I was, like, super, super excited when it came out. I saw it in theaters. I think I saw it in theaters three times.
Oh, nice.
Like, I saw it once by myself, then went on a not date to see it.
mm-hmm.
And then I think I went, like, again with my mom. And it was just like, you should see this movie.
What a weird movie to see if your mom.
I know. But she liked The Red Shoes. She always tell me that Red Shoes was a movie I needed to watch. So she asked me when I was telling her how good I thought this was. She's like, I should go see it.
I mentioned The Red Shoes while watching it with my wife this week because, I mean, the whole last act of The Red Shoes is just the play. And that's kind of what Black Swan does. The Black Swan. Black Swan.
I still haven't seen Red Shoes.
It's incredible. On that one on 4K, and whoo, what a delicious, what a treat for the eyes.
Yeah. So do you remember, were you impressed with Black Swan? Was it something?
Yeah. I do. I'm pretty sure at the time I saw it in theaters, now that I'm thinking about it. But I like you, I did watch it several times more early on. Like, I think maybe I've seen, this week when I watched it was the fourth time I've watched it, and maybe like the first time in 10 years. But right when it came out, I remember watching it several times, probably because I just kept watching it with people, like making them watch it, you know? And yeah, I remember at the time thinking it was immaculate. Like, I think I kind of held it in the same regard a lot of other people did. Like, yeah, the Academy obviously it was nominated for Best Picture. Natalie Portman won Best Actress. Like, it was critically adored, but I'm thinking more of like the general crowd. Like, I remember back then I had a Rate Your Music account, and I would rate all of my movies on there. And there was, that was kind of like the crowd that was into Black Swan, like true film lovers, like understood this movie was like deeper and doing more than like what other movies were doing. And I was on that train. I was like, yeah, this movie's, you know, above and beyond.
Right. It's the one. What a, oh yeah, that's the year that King's Speech won, which is,
yeah.
Like, I mean, King's Speech, I enjoyed it, but it was absolutely not. Okay.
It's one of those Academy movies where it's like, there's nothing wrong with the movie, but you're just like, how is this the movie we've chosen to remember for the rest of time was the best movie of this year?
I'm going to read through these real fast. Okay. You tell me which one would have won for you.
Okay.
King's Speech, Black Swan, The Fighter, Inception, The Kids Are All Right, 127 Hours, The Social Network, Toy Story 3, True Grit, and Winter's Bone.
Wow, I'm actually surprised Inception was nominated. Of all those movies, Inception's probably my favorite. As somebody who doesn't even really like Christopher Nolan that much, like, I love Inception. Other than that, none of those jazz me too much. I would probably say Black Swan would be number two.
Yeah, I think I'd probably go Black Swan, Social Network, Inception.
Oh, yeah. Social Network, I don't love it as much as I used to, but back then I thought it was, like, you know, the absolute shit.
Yeah, I also, like, I get frustrated with it. I get frustrated by biopics that take, like, huge liberties with the story. And like,
wow, that's Aaron Sorkin's specialty.
Yeah, it frustrates me a lot. And there's, like, people are split on that in terms of, like, you get the crowd that's like, it's a movie, deal with it. And then you get the crowd that are like, yeah, there's like, yeah. Do you have to do that? If you're going to tell the story, why don't you just tell the story?
I'm pretty split on it. Like, I understand both the arguments and could go either way. But what drives me more nuts than anything is just Aaron Sorkin's writing. Like, it just drives me nuts.
I know. Having now watched all of West Wing.
Oof, no thanks.
Going into a Sorkin movie, I'm just like, this is very Sorkin.
Yeah, I can't handle it.
Okay, so you liked Black Swan, Showing to Be. I was doing the same. Like, I mean, I think this was probably, I want to say I'm like plus or minus like two on like, this was my 10th viewing. So it could have been like, I've watched this movie 8 times. It could be I've watched this movie a dozen times.
Yeah, this is my 4th time watching it, but I really don't know. I could have seen it more than that for all I know.
It's one that I would put on when I was working. Like, I have like 50 DVDs that I would just kind of put a DVD in back in the day as I was like going about my day and let it play. And this is one that was like in that rotation.
Yeah.
So a few of them weren't like close watching, but it's just one where like it feels very familiar to me every time I watch it. But it's still like, every time I watch it, I feel like there's a new moment that I kind of appreciate seeing again.
Or totally. Like,
kind of discover it anew.
We must have been, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people are this way about movies, but I was like you, like there were a few movies that I just watched a lot because I own them, because I'm pretty sure I had Black Swan and DVD at one point. I got rid of most of my DVDs. But if I was watching a movie this much, it meant I owned it. And actually, I know Walk the Line came out a little earlier than Black Swan, but my wife and I just watched Walk the Line. And as I'm watching it, I was just like, I know every single second of this movie. Like, I must have watched this movie so... And when I think about it, I'm like, I probably can't even count on my hand like how many times I must have watched this movie because I know it so well. And Black Swan's the same. Like, as I'm watching it, I haven't seen it in 10 years, but like, I know absolutely every single beat. Like, nothing's surprising to me. I agree with you that there are like little touches you can find here and there, but like, I just knew the story completely.
Is it your favorite Aronofsky film? Or is it rank for you?
Let's take a look at this guy's. What's this guy got going on? I mean, I know I named a bunch of his movies earlier. I love Mother. Mother is probably my favorite, just like off the top of my head.
Only one I haven't seen.
I really love Mother. I don't think he has a bad movie. I haven't seen The Whale, I guess. So I don't know if I can fully say that. I think Requiem for a Dream is great. I think The Wrestler is great. Mother's probably my favorite, but like after that, they're all kind of in a tie. Like these are just all great, you know?
I need to rewatch. Like I feel like I'm a bigger fan of Noah than a lot of people.
Oh yeah, it's great.
I need to rewatch it to know how I'd rank it. I think I go like Black Swan, Wrestler, Noah as my top three Aronofsky, but I need to, like, Noah could go higher.
Yeah.
And The Whale, like, I'm finishing up the movie guide for The Whale currently, and The Whale's good. In some ways, it feels more like it should be like an early Aronofsky movie than a later Aronofsky movie. There's something kind of like smaller about it, or a little more art housey independent feel to it. Mm-hmm. It feels a bit more narrow or scaled down than something like The Wrestler, Noah, Mother. I mean, I haven't seen Mother, but I'm just imagining that it's kind of
it's pretty
board.
Nuts.
Yeah, with some of the others, like The Whale, you only have the one interior location the entire movie.
Yeah.
It's strange. It's still good, but strange.
Interestingly, like, I feel like you can describe all of his movies that way. Like, the settings are small. Like, you're kind of contained to one space and, like, very intimate with the character. But the places the movie goes, like, it feels ambitious. Like, all the different, like, themes it's covering, all the different little nuances of the character. He has just a very interesting approach to his characters that, I guess, like I said, it's very intimate the way he navigates them.
Now imagine that scaled down, and that's The Whale. Okay, so it's like, yeah, that minimalism, even like more minimal. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Okay, so Black Swan. Anything more like in our preamble?
No, I think going to this, here's the last thing I'll say, I guess, is that fond memories of Black Swan. I like Darren Aronofsky a lot, but going into this, I couldn't help but feel that, like, because I kind of think this when I look back at a lot of the movies from this time period. Like, I just talked about Walk the Line, a movie I have fond memories of and I still like. But as I'm watching Walk the Line last week, I'm kind of like, this is a pretty, like, straightforward, like, normal movie. Like, it was the most traditional biopic a biopic could be. It's James Mangold doing, like, his Hollywood, like, just master director thing. Like, it's perfectly edited in a way that's like kind of boring, you know? Like, mm-hmm. it just feels like how a movie's supposed to feel. Like, whenever I look back at movies in this time period like that, I always kind of wonder, is it going to hit the same way? Like, back then, I knew nothing about movies and hadn't seen that many movies. So movies like this would blow me away. Now that I've seen a lot of movies, am I going to watch Black Swan and like be blown away by it? So that tension was kind of there as I watched it.
I had a similar thing with just, you know, when I've seen the movie so many times, and I just, you know, updated our movie guides on it a couple months ago. So it's not like it's been years since I've seen mm-hmm. it. I think I've watched it in 2022 or 2023.
I was like, what?
So there was still a feeling of like, because I need to watch it, is it going to be as enjoyable? And for me, at least, like, I just get so swept up in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about the music, some of the scene structure, especially the end, like the performance and the build to her finally having the wings and that key yeah. shot, right? The premiere like S tier shot that this movie has of her going full swan.
Yeah.
It just gets me every time.
Yeah. So here was my experience watching the movie, and I kind of went into it with that attitude of like, is it going to hit the same? And which probably wasn't the best attitude for me. I think Chris can attest to this. I'm a little bit of a contrarian by nature. Like, there's a part of me that wants to like not like Black Swan because everyone likes it. I do like it, and I enjoyed watching it a lot. But that little aspect was there for me. And I will say from the beginning, and part of this is aided by the fact that I know this movie completely and are not like surprised in quotes by anything, that for the most part, Black Swan feels like a very straightforward movie, which was like that itch. I was kind of having that itch for the first maybe hour of watching this movie because, as Chris knows, since he wrote the explanation for it on our site, it's been one of our most popular articles for years. People search this movie all the time. It has remained relevant for a lot of people. And so in that respect, I was kind of like, what is it about this movie that people are searching? Like, what is so confusing about this movie? To me, it's kind of straightforward in the sense that a lot of movies using the hero's journey are straightforward, like Star Wars, Harry Potter, like this idea of like your light and dark side and it, and having that internal battle. Like, that's such a common storyline that I saw it playing out in Black Swan. Exactly. That it wasn't like, as I'm watching, I'm just like, is there going to be more? Like, I'm going to get something from it. And I think because I had that attitude, I wasn't allowing myself to get swept up in the movie. But at some point, I think I just kind of like, I shed that light I was putting on it and trying to like put the movie in a box and just allowed it to be what it was. And when you kind of ignore that, what the movie is inherently doing is very simple. It's kind of a masterful movie. Yeah. Maybe not like personally, like maybe not like my favorite kind of movie, but like objectively when I'm watching it, just the way shots are framed, the way the movie's lit, the kind of performances you're getting, like everything is so exact in a way that you're like, oh, a master made this. Like, somebody who had a pure vision of something like made it come to life. So as I kind of settled into that and realized what the movie was doing, you know, it was an absolute delight to watch.
It really does feel like Aronofsky, you know, he had four films under his belt at that point. The Wrestler, I feel like, was a tipping point for him.
Mm.
Like, Pi and Requiem had more of that like auteur energy to it. The Fountain was him trying to go a little more like big budget.
Yeah.
And then The Wrestler just kind of synthesized a lot of what he was doing. It felt like he found a voice in a way. And then Black Swan really, I think, combined all of that into this very, I mean, maybe even form and function in that sense that ballet itself is so precise and demands so much. There's almost this idea that in making a ballet movie, he was carrying some of that energy into his own filmmaking. But yeah, every time I watch it, there's just something, just the use of body horror in it. Mm-hmm. I kind of forget how much of that is present in the movie until I'm watching it again and I'm just like, oh yeah, oh yeah. And just the way it uses mirror elements or that externalization of Nina's identity, even with scenes like her and her mom, when they both have their hair down and you can see how similar they look at times, and that dynamic between them, the way that the mom's kind of putting pressure down on Nina, even gets jealous of Nina, that there's a similar dynamic between the mom and Nina versus Nina and Beth, and just the interesting relationship dynamics, the paintings.
Yeah, it's, you know, as I was kind of sitting there judging the movie, not really judging the movie, but like wondering, like, when is something more going to happen? And upon reflection, realizing that there wasn't like more happening, like that there wasn't, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like you understand. It's not like we hear some exposition that makes Nina's mental state make sense. You know, it's not like we hear something about her from her past that's like, oh, like this is why she acts this way. Like, you're kind of just thrust into the movie and you watch her just fall apart in front of you, and like you're with it. Upon reflection, I realized like that's exactly what I want movies to be doing. That is completely what post cinema is. And Chris has heard me talk his ear off about post cinema and this new wave of movies that is very much done in that style, where you don't need a bunch of exposition about somebody, you don't need like the narrative mechanics laid out for you. You don't need to be guided through a movie. You're just kind of experiencing it. You're in it. You're in the shit with them. You're watching things unfold as they unfold. You're understanding things as they understand things. And you're constantly lost in the chaos with the person. That's exactly what this movie's doing. It's kind of beautiful how it navigates this mental illness, how it just the unfolding of the mind, like these things that are very inherent to the human condition, things like we can all recognize and understand on a much less exaggerated level. Like, obviously this is exaggerated to the point where like she thinks she's becoming a black swan, like she kind of loses her sense of self, her innocence is completely wiped away. Those are all just like ticks and rhythms we can recognize in ourselves. But to see it blown up to this level and to be on that journey with her so intimately, it's such a great use of post-cinema and like what has become this leading movement and how to navigate cinematic narratives. I just, it was so pleasurable to watch like an early example of it working so well here.
Yeah, it's... that show versus tell dynamic as well, mm-hmm. where you just get like that idea of discovery with the movie. And the show versus tell movies, I think, and as you're saying, like post cinema movies, it's something where they tend to create a lot of conversation because you don't have that moment of exposition. So yeah, I can imagine mm-hmm. the first hour of Black Swan, it is a lot more grounded in that way. And it's, I mean, you get some of the duality, like the woman that walks by Nina when she's walking at night and it's like, is that Nina's face? Like, some of those things start to increase, but really that lasts like 40 minutes really takes off in terms of what's real, what's not real, what's real, what's not real.
Yeah, it's... I just love it because I was, again... a little curious. Even after all that, I was still curious at the end of the movie, like, what are people so confused about? Like, it seems straightforward to me. And as I'm looking, I found this Reddit thread of somebody who thought that the whole movie was a depiction of Nina dealing with trauma after being molested by her mother. which was like a crazy intense reading. But they had all these examples of like why it was. And they're reading into all of these little elements that the movie gives you that, you know, each one of the examples, you're like, okay, I guess that could be true. But because the movie's so light on exposition and details, it kind of makes you realize that you could read into anything like that. And it kind of reveals the beauty of both Pulse Cinema and what this movie's doing is that because nothing's exact, because nothing is so detailed, that because you're just solely meant to experience it and kind of be with the character, that you have the freedom to apply like whatever you're bringing into the movie, I guess, you know, like whatever energy, whatever emotions, whatever trauma history you're bringing into the experience, like your worldview, this kind of movie allows those elements to blow up and really hit, which is another reason I love this approach to movies, is that it just makes it feel more intimate and personal, you know?
Yeah, that's something that's always an interesting discussion, is especially in terms of what we do on Film Colossus, is that we tend to attempt to give more objective readings. And I'm saying objective with like some degree of quotes.
Totally.
Because people always, you know, have their interpretations of things, and even the kind of analysis that we bring, is it going to be like 100% complete or not have room for debate? But it's something to where like it feels like a general concept in Black Swan is like, that's not the focus of the movie. Like, from the approach that I would have, is like the critical, what do we see as like a primary concern of this movie due to some of the emphases or things that are emphasized.
Mm-hmm.
It seems much more about like career pressure, the search for perfection, and just this idea of duality and being in touch with yourself and repression. And they talked about how this is a companion piece to The Wrestler.
Totally. And they're like the Wrestler, same movie.
Yeah, like very much so. And The Whale in some ways also feels like similar to these. Different, as it's not necessarily profession driven in the way those movies are, but similar in terms of like being overwhelmed by something. And what it drives you to do. But that is one of the beautiful aspects of art and movies, is that you have the ability to take these readings and view it through these different frames and lenses. And those aspects of the movie, as you're saying, are there, to the point where if somebody wants to look at Black Swan through that lens and construct a point of view around it, you really can do that. It's one of my favorite things to kind of encounter on our website when people leave comments, is just like reading movies through a lens that we didn't take with it, or had it even like thought to take with it.
Yeah. And I think that's the beauty of what we do. The fact that we have these movie guides, that I agree with you that no movie can have an objective reading, but one thing we can do, and what I think our movie guides allow people to see in movies, is that there are inherent themes and motifs and ways of thinking about the title of the movie. There's these things that are just a little more concrete that give the movie some texture, or give the movie a foundation, I guess, and then allows somebody to add texture, that you can look at the movie and its theme of perfection. Of course, perfection is the theme of this movie. We can discuss that all we want on our site. But then how does somebody see that theme of perfection? How does that relate to their own lives? Like, that's the beauty that comes with film discussion and film analysis. And the best part of Aronofsky is I think his movies just provide a safer space for those discussions. Like, sometimes, again, I mean, I've talked about this before, some people are just like too exact. they're telling me exactly what the movie is, and there doesn't feel like there's as much room to talk about it. But Black Swan, again, you're not getting a lot of exposition. You don't know a lot about Nina. You don't know about the mother. You don't know where the father was. Like, there are all these what ifs and but ifs kind of going on throughout that allow the story to gain that power, that allows it to mean more personally to people. Again, I think that's a big reason why Aronofsky hits home with so many people.
Yep. I will say that the biggest change in the dynamic that I've had with this movie has been watching Perfect Blue.
Oh, yeah.
And then realizing how much Aronofsky used from Perfect Blue for Black Swan.
Mm-hmm.
That just in some ways, it's one of those things where I feel like is a little bit of loss of innocence when it comes to like
yeah
somebody like intaking movies and art. And I feel like when I was younger, there's all this like idea of like, how did this person come up with this idea? Oh my God. Like the idea of like the potential and this huge like inspiration and creativity. And then as you learn more about art and specifically like the process of creating art and the influences that people have, you start to realize how everything is just something else.
Yeah.
And that can be really original. It can still be like a very impressive take on something or synthesis of multiple stories. It's not saying like originality is dead or non-existent, but it's just, you see, I went from viewing like Black Swan as, oh my God, Darren Aronofsky, how could he ever, to just being like, oh, he watched Perfect Blue and then just put it in ballet.
He rocked. Like, yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
He copies. Sorry, go ahead. You're talking.
Oh, no, go.
I was just going to mention that he copies the bathtub scene to Requiem for a Dream as well.
Yeah, that's kind of like the narrative with this movie, is that it was said that in Requiem for a Dream, Aronofsky had to buy like the North American rights to Perfect Blue to recreate the scene with Jennifer Connelly like screaming in the bathtub, which is like shot for shot out of Perfect Blue, which for people that don't know, Perfect Blue, anime movie from 1997, I believe it was, in Japan. And it tells a story of Mina. It's Mina, right?
I Mima. Don't remember. Mimi, I think.
Not, definitely not Mimi.
It's not Mimi?
It is absolutely not Mimi. We gotta look.
Mima. Okay. I knew. Yeah. We were close.
Yeah.
It's a combination of Mimi and Nina.
Yeah. 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 Or just Mima.
Her name should have been Mimi. I'm going to throw it out there right now.
Just buy the rights to it. Change your name. So Perfect Blue, it's based on a novel called Metamorphosis, I believe it was. Yeah. And it's a Japanese pop star who decides to leave the group that she's part of and pursue a career as an actor. And in the midst of this, she goes through this whole identity crisis. The story that she's cast in, she plays a character that's having delusions and may or may not be a killer. And that starts to play out in her own day-to-day life as she can't tell the difference between reality and her own imagination anymore. And there's this double of her that keeps appearing. At first, on trains in the windows. And then just as she's walking around, she keeps seeing the reflection. There's confrontation between them. It's when you watch Perfect Blue, you see a lot of how it influenced Black Swan. Even the name of the character, right? Mima and Nina.
Yeah.
Like it's very, but apparently like Darren Aronofsky didn't buy the North American rights. Like there's some debate about that. He says that, he liked Perfect Blue, but it wasn't an influence for Black Swan. But then, like, he praised Perfect Blue a ton after Requiem for a Dream came out. And apparently, the creator of Perfect Blue, Satoshi Kon, was kind of upset at first that he didn't get a little bit more credit or recognition or maybe even like payment for the use of his work in Requiem for a Dream when it was like that direct. I don't know how he would have felt about Black Swan. He passed away in August of 2010.
Yeah.
So I think he had known that it had similar, because I think it had premiered already at like Cannes or something. Oh no, Venice was its initial release. So he passed away just like a week before the movie came out. But there was something that took like a little bit of the, like a little bit of the shine off of Black Swan. When I think about it, when I watch the movie, I'm still like very impressed and like caught up in the performances and the details, the shots, and of course that build to Nina's like grand moment of perfection. And I think that theme of perfection and Nina wanting to be perfect, and how this movie explores perfection and craving perfection and the way in which that can be destructive is incredibly powerful and incredibly relevant, and maybe even more so in this modern age when you have so many people that are on their independent grind, as you know, independent artists, independent creatives, social media like influencers. There's always something you can be doing, and there's even more of a demand to present yourself, even in your day-to-day, if you're trying to get recognition on Instagram, on TikTok, on YouTube, to present your life in a certain way and to present yourself in a certain way, which I think is a core pressure that Nina has in this movie of how do I present myself as someone that may not be who I am at home, and what is the pressure of presenting myself and being perfect all the time for this audience of people, and the demands of that and the psychological like pressure of that. It just still feels incredibly relevant to this day.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Yeah, I pretty much have been thinking, that has been the number one thing I've thought about in regards to this movie, because I think you and I can both relate to that as writers, as people like trying to get our voices heard about the way we speak about movies and our philosophy on movies. You have to be loud. You have to get out there. You have to like throw yourself out on social media. You have to grind. Like that perception of perfection and what it means, and pushing yourself to the edge and writing more and doing more and talking more and presenting better ideas, like that kind of pressure is, I completely agree that I've thought about that a lot. And mostly what I've thought about in that regard is how much I've gotten away from that. which again, like that's the beauty of a movie like this, is you're able to apply that lens to it, like how your own relationship with perfection, like me, for me personally, it was regressing from that and realizing like that's not what I wanted and what it was doing to me to act like that, and finding more balance in your life. And that's ultimately why I really like this movie and consider it a very optimistic movie despite its dire ending, is it's a call to finding that kind of balance and not pushing yourself to the edge, and what it actually means to be perfect in quotes. Because technically that performance she had wasn't perfect. Like she fell at one point, and because she fell though, like the performance ended up having this tension and this build and ultimately a catharsis it wouldn't have had if she fell. Like, there are this kind of little beauties that come from this push for perfection in these moments where you are imperfect and realizing that you don't need to be that way to, like, find the true beauty of your art, of who you are. So that was the lens I was kind of putting on it the whole time.
Very much. Like, I think about, you know, even us with our content creation, the podcast, trying to do YouTube videos. I was a mentor at South by Southwest the last 2 years. And the first year that I did it, I had a lot of, like, I think 4 of the 5 mentees I talked to were students at Ohio University, which is very kind of them to, you know, fill my slot so I don't feel like nobody wants to talk to me.
Right.
But there were a lot of people that were like young musicians, young filmmakers, they're in that program, but they were wondering, like, how do you get over that hump of feeling like something's good enough to be put out into the world? And I think that's the thing that I hear the most. I've talked with people that were like, oh, you have a YouTube channel. I want to start a YouTube channel, but I really want to, like, research everything and get, like, the best camera and find out, like, the best editing tools and, you know, edit a couple of videos. But I tried editing one and it took me a month to get it exactly perfect. And you do hear stories of people that spend that much time trying to be perfect and it can work for them. But I think more often the result is that you get paralysis. And the more that you're able to say, like, I think this hits a certain level of quality and people will be forgiving for the most part.
Yeah.
There's a lot of power in that, to know that the imperfections, as you're saying, can be endearing. They can add something to it that makes it a lot more engaging or unique. Or, I mean, even the best things in the world, that was another, like, loss of innocence for me. I used to think that like, businesses and companies that were, like, at the very top did everything perfect every single time. And you eventually realize, like, no, they make bad stuff, they do stupid stuff, they, like, release things early. Like, AAA video games that come out now are full of bugs. Like,
yeah,
movies have, like, bad marketing sometimes. Like, nothing's perfect, no one's perfect, and you can spend all this time trying to be as perfect as possible and just end up hurting yourself.
Yeah. One other thing I'll say about this, I guess, about Aronofsky in general, because now he has 4 actors who have won Academy Awards, right?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
This is all relevant to the way we've spoken about him and the kind of the space he creates for his characters. A, he's very intimate. B, he doesn't give you too much information, so it kind of allows the actor the freedom to explore within the movie, like, what their tics and rhythms are and what's driving them. There's just a certain, it gives a certain aura to his characters that allows them to flourish. And it, obviously, it's worked for the actors, because say what you want about Aaron Aronofsky, like, maybe you don't like his movies, like, the people in his movies, like, they have their moments in his movies, like Mickey Rourke and Natalie Portman and Brendan Fraser. It's crazy to think of the places those people all went to in his movies. And again, it's just that focus, that intimacy. It's such a unique quality he has.
Yeah. So it's those 3 all won, like, best actor in their category awards. And then Ellen Burstyn should have won for
Requiem. Oh, did she not win? I was thinking she won.
She did not win. Mickey Rourke did not win either.
Huh. Mickey Rourke didn't win?
No.
Really?
He was just nominated. Same with Marissa Tomei.
Who won that year?
2010, Best Actor in a Leading Role. Let's see. It was... God damn it. Colin Firth, King's Speech.
Oh, wait. Oh, I thought King's Speech came out in 2010. because The Wrestler came out in 2008.
Yeah, wait. I clicked on the wrong year, didn't I?
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, no, I just went to the wrong year. 2008. It was, Sean Penn as Harvey Milk.
That's right. God, I don't know why in the regresses of my mind, Mickey Rourke won. I guess everyone just was talking about him so much that year.
Recesses. I think that's twice regress. You said regresses of your mind.
Did I really?
Yeah.
Whoops. Well, you know.
That was kind of a stacked year. Like, Sean Penn as Harvey Milk, Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler, Brad Pitt and Benjamin Button, Frank Langella as Richard Nixon and Frost Nixon, and then I didn't see The Visitor, but Richard Jenkins
got it. Oh, yeah. I remember that. Damn. So he's only had two winners. In my mind, God, I thought he had four. I was twice too many.
Yeah. You were ready to give him all the accolades.
Well, still. I mean, they keep getting nominated. I guess we can give him that.
Yeah, that's certainly something. Well, then, I guess anything else on the movie itself, or?
No, I just think it's really well done. Again, just from an objective standpoint, like if you were to sit down and, like, I have this book that is all the different, I forget the name of it. It's a book I think a lot of people have, that it details all the different kinds of shots that can be in a movie, you know, like a long shot, a medium close-up, blah, blah, blah. And the term the book uses throughout is visual poetry? I can't remember what the name of it is, but like basically just the sequence of images and how you can like look at all the frames of a movie and see what they add up to, like what story they're telling just visually without having to like hear anything. This movie's, it belongs in that camp. Like it's just kind of perfect in that way, that every little decision made, it feels so planned out and realized in a way that it's hard not to love this movie.
Yeah, it really is. And speaking of love, Natalie Portman met her husband during this movie.
Oh, yeah. Who is he?
Benjamin Millepied. He's the guy that's the prince who's dancing with her. I guess guy that drops her.
Yeah, that was going to be my guess of the person she married in this movie.
Yeah, it's I remember this movie coming out and me being like, ah, Natalie Portman. And then I looked and I was like, she married him. I was like,
yeah.
I missed out.
Everybody in this movie is great. Like, yeah. Mila Kunis, I'm not trying to shit on Mila Kunis. I loved her in That 70s Show, but I kind of had this perception of her. She hasn't been good since That 70s Show, or maybe she just hasn't had the right role since then. But she's really fucking good in this. Like, she has such personality. Like, Vincent Cassell's always awesome. Winona Ryder's always awesome. They're just all doing good work.
I think this was the first movie I remember ever seeing, like, Vincent Cassell in.
Oh, yeah.
So it was kind of, I was just like, this guy has got, like, a lot of screen presence, which makes sense. No, I watched Eastern Promises. I saw that in theaters, so I guess I would have. But this was the first time I was just like, I need to know who he is.
He was a face. Like, as I was watching it two nights ago, I saw him and, like, I know this guy's face. Like, I know his name's Vincent Cassell, but I'm like, I feel like I can't remember what movies I've seen him in. I was like, have I seen him? Like, I just couldn't think of it. And I was like, well, there must be, like, one movie I've seen him in. And then I went to Letterboxd and looked at his top, it shows you like the top eight movies they're in, and I had seen every single one. I was like, oh shit, like he's in La Haine, like he's in Ocean's 13. He's just, I guess, I mean, I'm saying I don't remember in those movies, which is a disservice to him, maybe makes it sound like I'm shitting on him, but I feel like he's always really good. Like I suddenly did remember, like, oh, of course he's in La Haine, like of course he's in Eastern Promises, and yeah, he always has such presence.
I think there was just something different about the Black Swan role where he got to kind of feel forefront in a way that maybe some of the other movies, it wasn't necessarily him.
Yeah. That's one last thing I will say about this movie that I really did appreciate is it's a serious movie. Like, it's about very serious topics and very serious things happen, But I couldn't help, and I don't know if filmmakers like Darren Aronofsky would hear this and like be offended, but the whole time I was watching the movie, I was like, this movie's kind of funny. Like, it's kind of like ridiculous, like Vincent Cassell's character and like how flamboyant he is and like just how innocent and shy Natalie Portman is. Like, everything feels so extreme in a way, it all the way down to like the pictures that their mom was painting or moving. Yeah. You know, like all that stuff is like, is this supposed to be funny? Like, and if it is or if it isn't, I don't know, but like I found it funny and that increased my enjoyment of it.
There, I get what you mean. Like, the relationship I have with this movie and part of the enjoyment, like the first few times I watched it, there was such like heaviness to everything. Yeah. Like, oh, will she get like the role or not? And once I had watched the movie enough times to kind of like have less investment in the initial superficial aspects of it, there is something just like a little funny about like Nina going up to the girl and being like, congratulations. And the girl's just like, you bitch.
Yeah.
Like walks away. And just some of those dynamics and interactions, or just, I remember how like aghast I was at the masturbation scene. Like the first attempt where she like rolls over and sees her mom.
That shit's crazy.
Just like, ah, like that. I'm a very vicarious feel the emotions that the people on screen are feeling. So that just like,
I found that moment funny.
And now I find it funny. Like now it's funny. Like, but initially the first few times I was just like, oh my God.
I know
my
God. It,
and now it's just like, that's so funny.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
Or like when she goes up to Natalie Portman, she's like, yeah, about last night, or goes up to Mila Kunis and is like, about last night. And Mila's just like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, she has a little dream about me.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, it is kind of like a funny movie, even kind of the end at this point.
Yeah.
When Nina's like, I'm perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. I'm telling you, like, that's just, I can't help but have that perception of it, which is funny because I don't think I would feel that way about other Aronofsky movies. Like, I'm not going to laugh at Requiem for a Dream. There's nothing funny about The Wrestler, you know?
Yeah, but there's something just like a little, and it's not in like a bad way of like, oh, this is so bad. It's just something in the seriousness of it brings it back around to being a little like humorous.
Totally. I just it makes me appreciate it more. Like it increases my engagement with it, that it kind of has like a poppiness to it, you know? Like it's just so ridiculous in a way that feels confident. Like it's one thing to be ridiculous and like, you know, it's like The Room and like the person just has like no idea what they're doing. It's another where like this feels so exact and over top at the same time that I feel like I'm in on the joke.
It's okay, it's not American Psycho, right?
Right.
Where it's just like so like
that's like,
I thought
satire.
About that. You can have them. Yeah, there's just so many like amazing, but there were people that like took American Psycho very seriously and didn't realize it was satire, that it was supposed to be funny. Same thing with Starship Troopers, right?
at that point, that people weren't, just didn't understand that Paul Verhoeven was having fun is ridiculous.
Yeah, but I don't think there was that intentional like streak of satire in there, but it wouldn't surprise me if Aronofsky was like kind of aware of,
totally,
there just being like a little bit of, is it this kind of ridiculous?
I completely agree. And the fact that I recognize that, and I think that's there, like, again, makes me like the movie more, that it's not so self-serious, that it has a kind of playfulness about itself, and that playfulness doesn't necessarily take away from what the movie's exploring. Like, it still hits very hard.
Yeah, and I think that form and function, like duality, is such a huge part of the movie. To have this drama also have this element of comedy,
yeah,
to it, whether intentional or not, is just so fitting.
One last thing I'll say about this movie is I did not remember that Sebastian Stan, the Winter Soldier, was in it.
Yeah, he's one of the club dudes, right?
Yeah, that was a complete surprise.
Just like, is that Sebastian?
He's like, he looks so much younger, yet exactly the same.
Just like, what's Stanny Boy doing here? I like to think he wasn't even, like, he wasn't even cast. He just kind of heard the music and walked in.
Yeah, and they're like, I'm wow, gonna, what a good-looking gentleman. Scene. Yeah, you'll be a superhero someday.
You just dance with her. He's like, yeah, I was already doing that.
I like to think that this movie is the origin story of his Fresh character.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. That would have been a connection. Just in the middle of Fresh, he's just like, one time I danced with a ballerina at a club.
I tried to get her back to my place, but she was crazy.
Yeah, alas. Did it go well, but gave me a craving as a cannibal.
Yes. Well, he doesn't eat people, does he? Oh, wait, he does.
It's part of his whole, like, club. Well,
I know. I just remembered him sending meat to people, but I first was blanking on him actually eating people, but he does.
Yeah. It's a very, like, dystopian Blue Apron.
Yeah.
Okay. And then this movie still, like, seems beloved. And Aronofsky, like, is still relevant. It feels like, you know, Mother was maybe, I mean, Noah and Mother back to back didn't receive all that great of acclaim. Though yeah. Noah did do really well at the box office.
Oh, that was the other thing about Box One I didn't realize. A budget of $13 million and it made $330 million. Even Archer is just like, that's crazy.
I'm trying not to say anything so it doesn't.
But I just think that's nuts. Like, the fact that this movie had a, I guess thinking about it, it makes sense that it had a $13 million budget, but it does make me respect the movie more that it didn't need all the fluff, you know? Like, the CGI was minimal, yet it was like, it felt extremely.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like the CGI with the wings and some of the, oh, when her legs break backwards.
Yeah, shit's nuts.
The Wrestler, $6 million budget, $44 million box office.
Yeah, that makes sense for that movie.
And then you double it and get like 10 times or more than 10 times the money. That's 30 times the money almost. That's insane.
Yeah.
But Noah still, like, the budget for Noah is wild. Like 125 to 160 million.
That's crazy. That must have been the moment, like, that was Darren Aronofsky's moment, like, where he was given that kind of budget because of, like, his success of Black Swan. And it just didn't pan out, and he probably just hasn't gotten that kind of budget since.
I know. Oh, I mean, the box office for Noah was still like $360 million.
Yeah, it's a worldwide kind of movie.
But yeah, that's one of those things where, like, you got to imagine the marketing, like,
yeah,
the actual take back, and then Mother $30 million, 44 box office.
Man,
but The Whale kind of put him back. $3 million budget. That makes so much sense. Wow. So he had half the budget that he had for The Wrestler?
That's crazy. No movies are made for $3 million anymore.
No. He was just, wow.
Independent movies aren't made for that much.
And he's like, give me $3 million and I will give you an Oscar.
Brendan Fraser does come cheap, so I get it.
Yeah, I guess so.
He was out of work.
There was just like five actors in this movie.
Yeah.
Six, if you count the pizza delivery guy that shows up for 10 seconds.
And I do.
That's funny. That, okay. Some things are making more sense to me now.
Dude, you got to watch Mother.
Yeah, I should. I should watch
it's
that.
It's so good.
I'm trying to get through all the Scream movies so I can see Scream 6.
Oh, you've never seen all the Scream movies.
Just one and the last half of five.
I enjoy them all besides the remake. Or not a remake. It's not a remake. It's a reboot, I guess.
Yeah, that was five?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I did not like what I saw there, but rewatching, like, I just rewatched the first one the other night, and I was like, still good.
Oh, the first one's absolutely immaculate.
I don't like, my only complaint, I have two complaints about it. One, I don't think either of the characters would have the dialogue in the opening phone call. Like, I can't picture either of them like having that conversation with Drew Barrymore. And then second, like the end was a little bit of like a whimper to me, of just like ending with Courtney Cox and then turning the camera off into the hills. I was like, I feel like we deserve a little bit more.
Well, you're wrong and you're wrong.
That's simple enough. Puts it into context.
I love Wes Craven the death and Scream. It's just like, to me, that's just perfection.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
And all the other Screams. So you've watched all the first four?
No, just one in the first half of five, last half of five.
Okay, got it.
So I have no idea what happens in 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, they're all, the people that pop up in them are like Timothy Oliphant and Emma Roberts. It's just crazy, the people he has in those movies.
I forgot about Emma Roberts being in the one.
Yeah, okay. She's in Scream 4.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Okay.
What's our next movie?
Did we just jump right into Perfect Blue?
Oh, yeah. Why not? Hell.
That'd be a great 1-2 punch because, you know, as we were sitting here talking about Black Swan, I was thinking about Perfect Blue. And while I love the simplicity of Black Swan and the post-cinema-ness of it, there is something about Perfect Blue that it gives you more information and there's like more to chew on, that while I typically don't like that, like I really like it about that movie. Like, it navigates all that so well. So I think it'd be good to compare these two.
Another thing worth noting, should we say where this ranks in our all-time rankings?
Yeah. Let me pull up my all-time rankings. Have you done it for you yet?
No, I'm looking now and trying to figure out where I put it.
I feel like we haven't done this in a while.
No.
There was a feature you used to have in the show that I think we're both kind of like, we're done doing that.
Yeah, but for the individual, at the end of the discussion, it seems right that we should probably just say where we ranked it.
Okay, so this, for people who don't know, we have a list on our website, filmcolossus.com, where we're ranking every movie we've watched since 2022. I've done it since the beginning of 2022. Chris started in like the middle. So this is not, we are not ranking every movie we've ever seen, just the movies we've seen since starting that list.
Yeah. Otherwise, so many movies. Like, yeah, we'd have to add so many movies, thousands.
I mean, I want to do it someday. Like, I've thought about that a few times. Like, I would love to rank every movie I've ever watched. But for now, it's too daunting.
Yeah.
All right. My list has 348 movies currently, and I think I need to add more to that. But based on the list I have in front of me, I'm thinking it'd probably be around the 100, like 15-ish section, I think.
That's funny.
Which, you know, that's the top third of movies. Like, in my mind, like, that's a good movie because that's up near like some of my absolute favorites.
Yeah. My list is so much less built out than yours. I have 94, and a majority of them are ones that I've like seen to write about.
Yeah. Movies that came out like last year.
Yeah. So it's like almost primarily 2022 movies.
Yeah.
And like some 2023. So this is going to be like very high up. And it's a little jarring, I think, when it's going to be like as high as it is. I think I might have to adjust where Prisoners is on this list as well.
Where is it right now?
I have it at 6 currently.
Where do I have Prisoners?
That's under Avatar, Way of Water, and All Quiet on the Western Front, and Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, which doesn't feel right.
I have Prisoners at 310.
Yeah, you have it way low, but for me, it should be a lot higher. I think I'd put Black Swan at like number 2.
I was gonna say, I thought you'd put it at number 1.
No, I think I have American Psycho still higher for me.
Sure.
But Black Swan goes in at number 2 above Parasite. Like, I love what Parasite's doing, but identity movies are much more my jam.
Yeah.
So just in terms of like topic, and then that shot of Nina as the Black Swan is just, I don't think Parasite has the equivalent of that shot.
Yeah.
So, yeah, number two.
I'm looking back at movies I rated in 20, movies that came out in 2010. God, it's a lot of good movies. But of all those, I feel like it'd probably be in the top 10.
That makes sense.
God, I watched a lot of movies from 2010. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, like recently. You've watched a lot of movies from 2010.
Well, recently I probably did, but I'm just looking at like my all my ratings ever.
Oh, you're looking on Letterboxd.
Yeah, I'm just looking at all of them.
Okay, okay.
And so many artsy fartsy movies that I just like, this is my movie, you know, back then.
I'm trying to think if like Black Swan would be, it might be in my top like 50. I don't know if it would be in my top 25.
Yeah. It definitely holds a special place in just in terms of like my movie watching history. Like I will always enjoy this movie.
Yeah. Same.
All right. Perfect Blue. We're doing it, right?
Yeah. That's the next one.
I don't know when that episode will come out because I'm vacationing next week. So it'll either come out next week or the week after.
All right. We'll see. Surprise me.
Okay. Well, until next time.
See you, everyone.
Bye.
Got a big question to ask. Anything? Do you want to do anything?